Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Ever feel like your WordPress site is moving in slow motion? Switch to Kinsta's Managed Hosting for WordPress and watch it fly. Host your site on Google Cloud's fastest servers with worldwide data centers so your pages load instantly. Need help? WordPress experts respond in under 2 minutes and will migrate to your site for free. Try it yourself. First month free at Kinsta.com. That's Kinsta.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Are you looking to create safer spaces for cult survivors? Don't miss my video lecture on healthy and safer support groups for former cult members. It's a specialized kind of work with specialized sensitivities. As a therapist and educator, I break down the critical elements of establishing truly supportive environments for individuals who have experienced harm in high control groups and groups of any sort. Learn how to avoid potential pitfalls, maintain clear boundaries, create spaces that honor the incredible courage it takes for survivors to seek support, especially in a group setting when they've been hurt previously in group settings. Whether you're a mental health professional or support group facilitator, this lecture provides vital insights, I think, into protecting the healing journey of trauma survivors. So much of what I share, I've learned from the survivors themselves who have informed me about things that hurt them in the past. So these are things that they're looking for now to make sure they don't get re-injured in the same ways. This lecture and many more are available for purchase on my website, rachelbernsteintherapy.com. Just follow the link in the description of this episode to view them all and purchase any that are available that you think would be helpful to you in your work. Take good care.
Hi, everyone. Today on the show, we have Laura Caput, and she is a very active Jehovah's Witness whistleblower and international activist. For 8 years now, she's written submissions and given parliamentary testimony covering law enforcement agencies and government bodies and different politicians and inquiries, royal commissions, legal firms, and the media in relation to Jehovah's Witnesses and the Watchtower Society. She is co-founder of the victim advocacy group Say Sorry and the vice president of the Secular Association of New South Wales. She is currently in a modern slavery lived experience program. As a former government consultant who was not trapped inside by a husband or children, she has a different perspective than most and has a unique outlook that means that she's been able to travel and meet with other whistleblowers and survivors globally, which she feels very lucky for. For example, she was in the documentary in Germany, a news article that she was in was featured in a French program, and a few months ago was the speaker at the DECULT conference in New Zealand. She has a lot to share with all of us, and I'm so happy you get to hear her today. Here's Laura now. It is a total treat to have Laura Caput with me today because This is a topic that I think we have not covered nearly enough, not only about Jehovah's Witnesses, but about being a whistleblower in general, what that's like, what that life is like, what you're opening yourself up for, the bravery that it takes to do that, and the responses that you can get from being that brave person. So I would love for you to take a moment to introduce yourself, and then we'll start talking.
Thank you. My name is Lara Kaput, and I'm an accidental whistleblower. I was born into the Jehovah's Witnesses. I left when I was about 19, and I really forgot about the concept of being religious until we had the Australian Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse. And because of that, I made a submission. We had a lot of child abuse in our family. There were four girls or five girls alleged to have child abuse happened to them by five separate perpetrators. That made me make a submission. When I made a submission, I joined a support group. And when I saw what was happening in the support group with so much abuse, I then couldn't stop speaking out about it. So that's how I started.
Just that phrase, I couldn't stop speaking out about it. There is something about that when something drives you, when it would feel wrong not to do this, not to pursue it. It says so much about who you are and how important this subject is for yourself and for so many other people. And I'm wondering, just before we even talk about your own experiences, what has it been like for you to be getting the word out there, the responses that you've gotten? I'm sure they're kind of all over the board, depending on who's responding. What's it been like for you?
It's been tough. It's been very tough. And there's not as much support as one would hope that's required. So initially, I started making submissions. People just didn't read them. The government didn't read them. Our community really didn't read them. It felt like there was a lot of wasted work. And then when we started talking to the media, I found that many times people I'd encouraged to speak up got to D-Day and they didn't show, or they didn't reveal as much as they might have if they felt comfortable. So I found that I was often in the firing line of the media and also of the Jehovah's Witnesses leaders. I just found that we weren't getting a lot of traction. We would also be criticized by our own, the very people we were trying to help. I had a very intensive schedule. I've traveled internationally as a whistleblower. And so I'm often going from meeting to a story to catch up with a support group to helping whistleblowers make submissions or soon to be whistleblowers, survivors. So intense.
Yeah, quite intense. And I'm wondering also about the part of the world that you are in. It's not that it's been so much easier here in the States, certainly, for people to be heard, for people to be taken seriously. I wish it were a lot easier. I wish it wasn't that groups deemed as religions could hide behind that and could then cry maybe religious persecution or say that they have the right to do what they do, or it's religious teachings or whatever else. They have a lot of protections afforded to them beyond what I think should be the case, especially when it's covering up things that are illegal, immoral, unethical, putting people in harm's way in general. But I'm wondering, with your part of the world, and again, thank you so much for getting up so early in the day to speak with us before the sun has come out. That's really lovely of you. Tell me about, in your country, if there is just a lack of awareness or if there's an actual resistance to looking at this.
The answer is there's both. Yes, we certainly have been noticing that we get to a new government department and they don't know anything. There's no sharing between departments. And I've made probably a dozen submissions in my own country to various departments. What I have found is that often international governments will take action and be more interested, perhaps because I'm from overseas, just like you get this gravitas when you are visiting somewhere, you're a novelty. So I have found that actually a lot of action happens after we've left a country and spoken to people there, such as a charity commission or such as a politician or the media. And I did not know, this goes back to your previous question, how much power religion had. I really had no idea. And the reason for that is because Jehovah's Witnesses aren't allowed to vote. They also aren't really supposed to follow the democratic process. So many of us don't have any idea, you'll understand, about how the government works, about how to make a formal complaint, about the parliamentary process. And then oftentimes, maybe half of the times that I've made a submission here, the Jehovah's Witnesses will make an adverse response. They'll see my submission publicly and they'll respond to the government with essentially, she's telling lies. So the power of their propaganda is really strong and they certainly have a persecution complex. That's an issue.
Sometimes people will say to me, I think you're wrong about a particular organization. I've had nothing but a good experience. And so you're coming on too strong and you're being too critical and you should try it yourself. And often I will say to these people, have you ever told them no? Have you ever disagreed? Have you ever said, I'm leaving? Have you ever spoken out publicly about your experiences? Because that's when you often find out about the health and the true nature of an organization or even a person who you're with or a company that you're working for. Because if you are sort of going along with what's happening or you're touting the party line, then you don't really get to see how they can play dirty and how they can say that the person who is uncovering things is someone not to listen to and someone who's lying. And so when you tell me these stories that you're saying this is what happens there, and they're spending time, resources, to try to defame you rather than really looking at them and saying, oh my, let's try to find out what's happening within the confines of our organization so that people don't continue being hurt or we don't keep harboring or protecting perpetrators. That feels like focus better spent, but instead they just want to make sure that they are clarifying their PR, which again says a lot about how much an organization really cares or really doesn't.
Yeah, that's right. Recently I heard the term persecution signaling, and I think that applies to them. And I had that exact situation with my little sister. We were invited to be on a national TV program here in Australia. And my father and my little sister accepted, but I didn't know that because my little sister didn't tell me that. We just turned up on stage in front of the cameras and we were separated. So there were people in between us, sort of like a Dr. Phil show in a way. And she was never baptized, you see. I was baptized. So we had a totally different experience because she had never committed. And she was not quite as rebellious as I was. So she essentially towed the line. Our experiences were such a contrast. And she was very angry. She was angry at me. She said after the program that she wanted to know what I was going to say about her. That's why she came. And I intended to say nothing about her. I just wanted to demonstrate what had happened in the environment. And funnily enough, I did just that because after the program, a friend texted me and said, wow, the Jehovah's Witnesses are really dangerous. And I thought, that's the point I wanted to make, break up families.
My goodness. Okay, so that's a perfect segue. So let's go back in time here. I always wish I had sort of a special effect for that. And to go to your childhood. So you were born into this organization. It sounds like there are things that happen to you that might not happen to everyone there. But still, probably the way that it was dealt with or the ways you were not protected have to do with the organization, I'm assuming. But we'll talk more. So let's find out. Are your parents first generation or were they raised in it as well?
So my mother and father were both born in Germany and came to Australia when they were very little children. My mother's family had been Lutherans in Germany, like so many were. And then my father's family, part Polish, part Ukrainian. So therefore, they were primarily Orthodox. They came to Australia and the Jehovah's Witnesses had created a little brochure called Migrants, about so big, entitled Migrants. And they were really recruiting migrants at the time. So I was born in because of that. And my childhood was a relatively happy one, except for the Jehovah's Witnesses, I never believed. But my parents were Uber dubs. Uber dubs are really zealous. So it was a very strict childhood due to my mother. I sort of went along. I was very lucky because my father had not been born in. My mother essentially was, but my father had not been born in. He found it himself. And he was a scientist. He was a biochemist. The Jehovah's Witnesses really discourage tertiary education. Luckily for me, he had his degree. So it was quite easy for me to go to university. So I became an industrial chemist. I studied pharmacology and management. And I really didn't get a lot of pressure. However, my friends didn't have the same opportunity in the congregations. And I see now that very, very few Jehovah's Witnesses got a good education. And in fact, they're one of the lowest religions for advanced education.
That is very true. And I hear about people wanting to make up for that once they leave and being able to get a degree, go to school. It's amazing. I also want to say, just on a personal note, I love meeting people who seemingly have a very different life than mine, far away from where I live, but seeing how much crossover there is, it just reminds me of It's a Small World, sort of like we have so much in common. I have family from Poland, from Ukraine, from Germany. My last name is German, Bernstein, Burntstone, which I think means amber. From on my mom's side, a whole long list of professors of pharmacology, which is fascinating. So I just keep seeing all of this similarity. I just love it. I love it. I think it brings people together. Okay, so tell me also, before you continue, what you mean about your life with your mom guiding it that way, that it was very strict. So what does that mean in perspective? So we have a vision of what that is.
Sure. So I was non-compliant with things. For example, let's say I didn't do something immediately that I was asked to do, or let's say I didn't do something the way that I was asked to. For example, got my ears pierced before I was allowed to. I was smacked. I was smacked nearly every day. I wasn't beaten, so there were never any bruises. I didn't have to go to hospital and there were never any cuts. But I was always scared of being hit because I was always hit. Not by my father. I remember being hit once by my father, but me and most of the people that I've spoken to who were little girls with me at the time were all hit by their mothers primarily. Some of them were belted by their fathers. Some of them were really very physically abused by their fathers. In one person's case, he would not tell his father a secret, and he kept that secret for a reason, a Jehovah's Witness reason, to be protecting of somebody else, and his father beat him for not telling him the name. I remember my mother talking about other Jehovah's Witness mothers being mean to their children. And as I got older, I thought, it's funny, you can see it in them, but you can't see it in yourself. I remember being hit with a wooden spoon, hit with a hose, hit across the face, just punished in lots of ways. I remember my father, which I actually preferred this punishment, but my father's punishment was to be on my knees facing the corner to think about what I'd done. I preferred that to being hit because it gave me time out. So that was the punishment that we got. And we always heard the phrase, spare the rod, spoil the child. So it was being preached from the platform to punish the children.
Which is incredible. It's wrong on so many levels. Just in terms of what we know also about child development, it's never necessary to think about needing to use corporal punishment. And especially if you're worried about spoiling a child. I mean, so many of the children now who are adults who I've worked with who were raised in Jehovah's Witnesses and others were far from spoiled. They really didn't get a lot of what they needed. There was this sense that unless you were what is perceived now to be abusive, that somehow you were doing a disservice to your children. It's all very backward, but it's all something that you see a lot in fundamentalist teachings across the board, actually. So it's interesting that your parents had different ways of approaching it, though, which is actually significant. So here you were someone who was not willing to be corralled, really, like told what to do at every level, which says a lot about your spirit, actually, which is not going to be winning you points in Jehovah's Witnesses, but in life outside is the thing actually that probably propels you to do a lot of very good things and brave things in the world. But yeah, you don't get that message early on. So keep going with your childhood and what else happened during that time.
I guess the biggest thing that was a change in my life was that my parents got divorced. I was somewhere between 11 and 13. Everything suddenly changed. And it changed because they both tried to get custody of us. So I have an older sister and a younger sister. And both my mother and father tried to get custody of us. My father was supported by the Jehovah's Witnesses. The Jehovah's Witnesses were mentioned more than 20 times in the family law court documents, which I now have a copy of. And I could read their testimony as an adult. My mother was called a Jezebel in court. That's not normal. She had to leave the Jehovah's Witnesses or was kicked out because she couldn't stay anymore. She's told me subsequently that she either had to leave or she would have committed suicide. And that's a common theme. I know a lot of people who've been suicidal or have a suicide ideation, including 4 people that come off the top of my head in my family who have either attempted or wanted to attempt suicide. So she left and we had to make a decision where to go. And because my mum was so abusive, physically abusive towards me, and my father was a kinder person, I didn't know where to go because he was still a Jehovah's Witness and she wasn't. So I wanted to go with a parent who wasn't a Jehovah's Witness. But for my safety, I went to my father.
No, it makes sense. It does.
No, I know it wasn't as safe as I thought it was.
Right. Seemingly on the surface from your past experience. I'm curious why your mom was feeling suicidal. Did that ever get explained? Because when someone is so unhappy and or abusive, it's hard to see them as people who are suffering as well. And so I'm wondering, what about that? Do you understand now?
I don't know the answer because I haven't discussed it with her in detail, but there could be a number of reasons. Because she's not here able to speak for herself, there's some reasons I can't say, but they exist regarding the Jehovah's Witnesses. I think she was very stressed and anxious. I became a stressed and anxious person. I believe she had felt sorry for her behavior because she sent me at least 2 apology cards. Didn't say what she was apologizing for, but it was to me from her with love and I'm sorry. And it may have also been that she was very intelligent. She is very intelligent and she may have felt stifled. My father is not a very effusive man, so you won't get much emotion from him. The last time I saw him a couple of days ago, I reached out to give a hug and he just looked so embarrassed. We've only hugged about 3 to 5 times in our adulthood. He doesn't show affection, possibly has some sort of maybe Asperger's syndrome or something like that that was never diagnosed because he was a war baby. We didn't have that psychology back then, I don't think. So there's a number of reasons. I would say the marriage and the pressure of the Jehovah's Witnesses and other factors within the Jehovah's Witnesses were the reason.
And I want to jump in here too and respect the fact that you don't and can't really speak for your mother in this way. And that's absolutely fine and right of you, but without making guesses about something so serious, I can share that there are a number of people I've worked with who were feeling suicidal while in the Jehovah's Witnesses. And it's an important thing to talk about if anyone listening is in that situation, that you know that you don't have to be stuck in that as your only option and that the only way out is to kill yourself. That is also never your only option. Even though it feels that way, just want to make sure to mention that when you are raised with so much fear or it's so drummed into you to be fearful of the world and what's going to happen, and that as soon as you are not under the quote unquote protection of the Jehovah's Witnesses, then all hell will break loose in your life, quite literally. Then you feel like, I have to stay in this thing that might be keeping me from living, but because I know that I'm going to have certain awful death, should I leave? And this is a false dilemma that is so severe that people are put in these situations. And there's always another choice, and always know that. So it is important to remember, you don't have to feel backed into this corner.
Thank you for saying that, because it still happens today that people make attempts. So it's really important. One of the things you may or may not know is there was a study done about 5 years ago in Western Australia, and it found that Jehovah's Witnesses have 3 times, in comparison to the general population, schizophrenia, and 4 times the amount of paranoid schizophrenia. There's a lot of adverse mental health within the Jehovah's Witnesses. I'm sure you know that about cults. The issue with that was we had a lot of mental health problems in our family. I mentioned we had stress and anxiety and the suicide ideation. We also had OCD. An uncle would never turn up to anything on time. It would always be 2, 3, 4 hours late. He had to wash his hands many times. That's one of the characteristics people are familiar with OCD. There was a lot of rageful shouting that was not normal that happened. There was also one uncle who was morbidly obese, for which we don't know the reason. As I mentioned before, there was a lot of child abuse in our family, and that affects you in many ways. So there was a lot of adverse mental health. Around the time that my parents got divorced, or just after that, my family was shattered, fractured, because 2 of my sisters went to live with my mum and only I stayed with my dad. And that's how my little sister was not baptized. I got baptized because I had met an eldest son. So I moved schools. We moved house because of the divorce. The family home was sold. Luckily, I had pets. I had a dog and a cat, and I would often cry into their fur from the heartache. I think that that was probably happening with all of us, because I remember hearing my dad cry at night, and it's a very sad thing when you hear soulful crying from the room next to you and you know exactly what's hurting them. So we joined this new congregation. I met an eldest son. I started going out with him. We did something that the Jehovah's Witnesses call porneia, which the regular world would just say was teenagers experimenting with their bodies, or petting is another word. Kissing heavily and touching each other. And for that, there was pressure on me, or before that, to get married or to get baptized, because I was dating an eldest son. So I did get baptized. Now, because the petting was revealed, he told his dad, I was invited to what's called a judicial committee meeting, where you have 3 elders who are judging you. And I never showed up, which is very, I guess, rare that someone doesn't show up to that. Usually people go through it. And I'm so lucky that I didn't go to it, because I see what happened. Them asking inappropriate questions and the feeling you have when you're a young woman walking to a meeting with 3 men that are very judgmental. I dodged a bullet there.
So glad you didn't. I've heard about so many of these, and the people have told me about the questions. Women told me, as girls, the questions they've been asked, and that they just thought, are these men getting turned on by listening to this? That's why they're so inquisitive. Are they really trying to keep me in line? Either way, it's none of their business, but I can't leave the room until I answer the questions. I mean, it sounds horrendous. And I'm so glad you didn't do it.
Yes, I know that I'm lucky. Another way that I'm lucky is that I never really believed it. So I recognized it wasn't the life for me. I recognized that I wanted to have an education. I wanted to go somewhere and do something different to what everybody else was doing. I saw the whole religion as very beige, and there was no role for women. There was no ladder, I guess, to climb, to strive for, to be interested in. And I'm very intensely curious, but I wasn't interested in doctrine. So there was nothing for me. I realized that I would have to get married and have children. And it was the last thing I wanted. I'd seen my parents divorce. I'd been the product of a fractured family. And I didn't want to do that to a child. I didn't want to be in what's called a headship arrangement with my husband because I'm quite independent. I'm really independent. I saw that with my mother and father, he was the passive one and she was more assertive. And I'm like that. I saw that it wouldn't work. It wasn't allowed to work that way. So I escaped when I was 19. I escaped. I realized I had most of my education. I was in a very poverty-stricken way at the time, and I was fearful of how I'd be able to go on and have enough money. But I was very lucky in that my Ukrainian aunt put me up at her house, looked after us. I met a man that I was going out with, and I was able to move in with him around the same time. Maybe just before that, I was living with three other girls, and they were all studying at uni. So it was a good environment for me. But when I left, I wanted all the things I couldn't have. So I started smoking, as girls did back then. I started drinking way too much. I was a teenage alcoholic, really, and I didn't realize. I was promiscuous, and that's because you were not allowed to have sex before marriage, and suddenly I was allowed to do anything. And I'm sure you've heard this many times, that people go off the deep end because they don't have their own boundaries. So over time, I recovered from that and became what you would call almost a normal person.
It's amazing. I think about that with having kids too who are beyond college age and one who is still in college. And I think about my own college experience with people who would drink into oblivion. And very often it was because they were never allowed to be anywhere near it. When there's forbidden fruit of any sort, then you can go beyond what is healthy for you and get very, very sick, very ill, or make certain decisions just because you can, because you're exercising that freedom. And then you hopefully rein it back in and realize that you want to do what's actually wise for you at this point and not just enjoy the freedom to do it. But it's hard. It's hard when you've been so restricted because you're like a kid in the candy store of life.
Yeah. And back then there were no support groups. So now there are lots and lots of people who've come out and created support groups. I mean, I've seen more than 100 for Jehovah's Witnesses, local, international, with different perspectives. So some of them are just socializing. Some of them are for whistleblowing. Some of them are for dating. I drank to the point of vomiting every weekend for 10 years. That's how bad it was. And it was such a waste of life. I wish that people listening, don't do that. Don't bother doing that. It's very expensive and it takes a toll on your health. And also, I lost a lot of friends because I was doing really inappropriate things. For example, I would put out my hand to shake someone's hand. And as they went to hold my hand, I'd pull it back. And I thought that was hilarious. But I noticed that they didn't. One time I was older than other girls at school because I left school at year 11, which is the second last year in school. And then I went back to go to university. But because of that, I was the oldest girl in school and I had a car. I was going out clubbing. I would be the driver. So I'd be the designated driver. And that really helped to reduce the amount of alcohol I was drinking. But I would still do stupid things that would really turn my friends off. So one time, one of my friends was trying to get into the back seat of the car, opened the door, and I thought it would be hilarious to drive off. It wasn't. It wasn't hilarious to drive off. And I was just hopeless. I was just that typical cult kid that looks weird and it does inappropriate things and doesn't know how to do their hair and makeup, doesn't know what to wear. I remember copying my friends' outfits because I didn't know how to wear a worldly outfit. I knew how to have dresses and put on heels and put on stockings and a petticoat and go to the local Kingdom Hall, which is the church, but I didn't know how to dress in my own clothes or do my makeup. So I read a lot of magazines and I copied my friends, which didn't get me more friends. I was just really awkward, just really awkward. So yeah, that was the result.
And people talk about also not understanding pop culture references and what's cool, what's not, the movies that people are talking about, anything. They can feel like they need to find a way to fit in, and maybe playing jokes is a way to do it. I also think there's something interesting about pulling your hand away and also moving as someone's opening the door to the car. I mean, I don't want to over-diagnose it here, but there is something about asserting power, having power in a certain situation. I think that when you're in an environment where so much of that is taken away, sometimes there is this sort of gleefulness in seeing what you can do and what you can take control over. And by pulling your hand away, you might think that you're taking control, keeping someone from doing the expected in that moment. But really, at the end of the day, it is awkward. It's uncomfortable. It doesn't bring you more community. It can be very isolating and you just might not know that. And yeah, these are things that sometimes you learn the hard way.
Yeah, that's right. And that brings me to two of the submissions that I've made. I talked earlier about being fearful of being outside the home because I was quite poor. We were quite poor. I guess we were lower middle class. I wasn't neglected in a physical way. I was in an emotional and psychological way, but I wasn't neglected physically. I had lots of food. I would go to the doctor. I would get good shoes from mum. She cared about those things. Her dad had been a pharmacist in Germany. I had those things, but when I moved out of home, of course, I had to provide for myself. So when I was living with the girls in a share house, you know, I was living on, I don't know, something like $250 a week. I would go to uni and then I would have a half hour's sleep and then I would start work and I would work till 9 o'clock at night. So I was busy for 12 hours a day. I would work. Back then we had a lot of penalty rates, which was basically you'd get paid more if you worked on a Saturday or a Sunday or at night. So I chose those jobs. It means I was perpetually tired and I had to study until 2 a.m. a lot. But luckily I was young, so able to tolerate that. So yeah, I wrote a submission about poverty. The Jehovah's Witnesses criticized my submission. They said that in my whistleblowing, I have spent about, over the last 8 years, about $150,000 Australian dollars. And they said in the submission, which I had revealed that it's making me poor doing this work. Sorry, I didn't quite say that, but I mentioned that I'd spent a lot of money. But I was really speaking on behalf of the community. And there was a Pew Research study that showed that the Jehovah's Witnesses are one of the poorest religions because you're only supposed to work part-time and the rest of the time you're supposed to have a relatively menial job so that you can proselytize all the time. So when I made that submission, I wasn't talking about myself at that time per se, because this is just a few years ago. I was talking on behalf of the community. They're very poor. And that's what was found in the research. So not only are they uneducated, a lot of the time, that makes them poor as well. But all of their time, and you would have heard this before, all of their time is taken up studying and preaching and following the rules. Their time is absorbed doing that. So they don't have the time to have a career. And I was very lucky to have a career. And the second thing that we've just discussed is the social isolation and loneliness that I had. You mentioned loneliness, I think. And I felt very isolated because, as you recognized, I'm now alone. I'm doing inappropriate things. I don't know how to live in the world. And I didn't want anyone to know that. I was fearful of them knowing and not having any of the language that we now know. I didn't know why I was feeling so bad. I was so angry. I was lost. And I didn't know why. I didn't know it was the Jehovah's Witnesses. Because I was disfellowshipped and shunned, that bit I got. I knew that this was probably forever. I knew and that this loneliness and separation from my family would be permanent. And I didn't know how painful it would be sometimes, but I knew that I would get more time in Jehovah's Witness jail than you'd get in a normal jail for murder. And it's now been 33 years that my family has been estranged from me. Most of the members, not every member, but most of the members. So yeah, I wrote a submission about that as well. And that submission was made to the local government here in the capital called Canberra. I tried to calculate how much that might cost the community in mental health counselling, for example, to demonstrate that this is not just a psychological issue, it's a financing issue as well for the government.
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting. I'm now remembering there was a family I was working with about 7 years ago now. The parents were divorced. The wife didn't want to be in Jehovah's Witness anymore, needed to divorce the husband. The husband then married another woman. They had six more kids, lived in a trailer similar to what you're talking about really not having. And it wasn't important to the Jehovah's Witnesses. But the thing that was difficult was that the children from that original union, they were told by their father to bring their mother up on abuse charges so that he could get full custody and bring them up the right way in the church. And that this was actually something that was happening in the community from that Kingdom Hall. If anyone's going through a divorce and whatever, here are the numbers to the Department of Children's Services. And so here, this nine-year-old client of mine, this boy, called the Department of Children's Services on his mother. He had a little sister who was then taken into custody. I mean, it caused so much upheaval. He has a tremendous amount of guilt still to this day about what he did, but it really wasn't because of him. He was told this is what God wanted from him, and it leaves people very confused and embroiled in things that are draining emotionally, but also financially, and it is unconscionable.
Yes, that's undue influence there, isn't it? When he's doing that because he's coached to do that. So I've heard that happen here as well. I heard that that happened in the Blue Mountains where people were accused of being child sexual abusers and they were jailed and eventually got out. And there's some sort of connection to the Jehovah's Witnesses. I'm not sure what it is because that wasn't in the media, but the story was in the media for a long time. I've also heard that happening not just in the congregation, but done by leaders. So I've heard of leaders reporting, for example, a whistleblower as being a child sexual abuser. And I've also heard of other things which you may have heard of. People are accused of being smokers when they're not to get them out. People are accused of planting a bomb to cast doubt on what they're saying to the police. So people who have spoken up before are then accused of things. So that's happened very close to me. I know of at least three people that that's happened to where they're accused. And again, it's a type of propaganda and it's really to put the police off the scent, I think. And I've also had, for example, I've had defamation happen against me and other people have also had defamation of claims that we've made that they say are not true. And somehow the Jehovah's Witnesses have managed to get that published either in this country or in other countries. So I'll give you one example that happened here. The Jehovah's Witnesses published defamation about me. They then had to write a submission to the government to provide progress on the Royal Commission. 5 years later, they had to continue providing progress updates. In one of the last progress update, they connected that report to the defamation that had been said about me. So the government accidentally republished that, not realizing the significance of what the Jehovah's Witnesses had done. There was no progress made to the recommendations from the Royal Commission. In another country, I have been defamed and so have others. For example, I did a documentary in Germany. The Jehovah's Witnesses had, well, I can't say this for sure, but I allege that the Jehovah's Witnesses had a consultant, an anti-cult expert. You probably know him. They're called Bitterwinter. Do you know Bitterwinter?
No, who's that?
I'll remember the guy's name in a minute, but they published defamation about me that I suggest the Jehovah's Witnesses put them up to and probably paid for. And then that defamation was republished in other languages. So Massimo Introvigne is the guy's name. Yeah, we know that the Jehovah's Witnesses use lawyers that we haven't heard of to write reports about whistleblowers. We also know that they pay cult experts like the Bitterwinter brand to write reports that they can then submit to the government or in court. So they're much more deceitful than people realize. I never knew that when I was young, never knew that until recent years. I suggest that those people who don't realize how dangerous they are, if they did some research on that, even that is difficult to find. So you may never know. But the Jehovah's Witnesses keep records. They keep records on their whistleblowers and they lobby in a way. They have a lobby group in Europe, for example, and they really used, as you mentioned before, religious freedom to say, look, we're being persecuted.
You wrote about it where, sorry?
In some of my submissions to the government.
You know, it's interesting because I think they might then know about you coming onto this show and they might have things to say about it. They're going to follow a lot of people. It's very similar to Scientology and how they write. I've talked about this on the podcast before, that there are whole teams of people within Scientology whose job it is to harass, whose job it is to follow what people are saying and doing, not to make changes within the organization so that people aren't harmed, but instead just to keep tabs on people who they see as the enemy. And a client who I had who came to see me for the first time, she came in, this was a few years ago, and she said, I want to start by apologizing. I said, oh no, you weren't late. I just thought, whatever. She was feeling guilty. A lot of former cult members feel guilty about something even before they've walked it, and they had to apologize. I'm thinking, what for? And she said, it was my job, along with about 7 or 8 other people who were sitting in a room, it was my job to harass you. If you saw a car parked in front of your house or being subpoenaed or whatever else, being threatened, I thought I was saving the world. I thought I was doing God's work. And I'm sorry. I mean, I realize I was just being an unpaid member of the army that was meant to protect the organization, not to help the world in any way. It was very interesting because I see a lot of similarities here. And so if people want to defame you in response to this, or defame me in response to this, I feel like I want to just say out loud, you're going to be tipping your hand. You're going to be showing who you are. You're going to be showing what this organization really cares about, which is its reputation more than actually keeping people safe within it. So, all right, do that if that's what makes you happy. But it just proves something about you, not about you, Laura, not about me, not about this process, because you're just saying what is, and they don't want people to know what is.
And did you notice that you were being stalked by people in cars?
Well, yeah, it was Scientologists. But yes, years ago, when I first started doing this work, there were these two very openly discredited Los Angeles Police Department officers who were terrible people, who were fired for harassment, doing very bad things, immediately hired by Scientology to be used as their PIs. And they'd be leaning on my car when I came out from my office or parked in front of my house. Some people dressed as janitorial staff and got into my office to try to get my client files, but they didn't end up getting them. I had things locked up because I had heard, be careful. And then they've complained to my board. Everything's been thrown out, except for one complaint that was to my board. That was done by Scientology, but they also tipped their hand about that. That was the latest attempt, because I got a call from the head editor of their online magazine called Freedom Magazine. It's always ironically titled things. And he wanted to know how I felt about the complaint against me to my board. And I said, what complaint? I hadn't been notified yet, which meant they were behind it because they knew about it before I knew about it. And he immediately hung up because he realized he had just blown his cover. But it cost me money, right? Like, I had to hire an attorney. I had all the things. But it goes back to, with your strength from a young age, not letting the bullies win, I think is part of your persona too. Like, I'm just not going to be intimidated away. Thank goodness for people like you who are willing to put up the good fight. Of course, only if it's safe, physically safe for you to do so, but I'm sure it gets wearing and difficult.
Yeah, it does. I actually have a stalker. I had to go to court to get an intervention order. I have a 5-year intervention order against a stalker. So yeah, it happens to us as well. You mentioned just now when you started speaking about unpaid army, I'd really like to talk about that if we can. There's two topics I'd like to cover. The first thing is, in regards to unpaid labor, I made a submission on modern slavery. And I made that submission with the allegation that the Jehovah's Witnesses are perpetrators of modern slavery. So modern slavery includes things like forced marriage and I've seen people who have been forced to marry other Jehovah's Witnesses. It also covers child labor. And I allege that I was a child slave laborer. I didn't consent and I didn't get paid for doing construction work on the kingdom halls or churches and at assembly halls, which is a larger regional building. And I also had to clean bricks and I had to sell magazines. Do you remember the Awake and Watchtower magazine?
Oh, yes. Very well. Yes.
We had to sell them as children. Sometimes it would be with our own pocket money. We were going from door to door for hours every weekend and no one stood up for us at that time because they didn't recognize what I say it is, which is slave labor, modern slavery. And then the third thing that I say within the modern slavery bracket that happens is trafficking. And what I mean by trafficking is, yes, there may have been some sexual trafficking, but I'm not aware of the extent of that. So I know that it's happened in a couple of cases that have been alleged, but I say that they send out their missionaries in a form of trafficking. So we get orders from head office in Pennsylvania and comes to Australia, head office in Australia to Sydney, and then the missionaries are sent from Sydney to third world countries, like Asian countries, for example. Southeast Asia might be an example of that. So we're getting instructions from America and sending Australian people to other countries to participate in more recruitment, I say deceptive recruitment, and also more engaging of children to construct kingdom halls in their country. I say that's trafficking. They're the things that I alleged, those types of things. We also had to do gardening for free. Some girls that I know of participated in babysitting other people's children. Now, in the world, you would get paid for babysitting a child. But in the Jehovah's Witnesses, it was expected that you kept giving everything, yourself, your resources, your money, and your children over to the Jehovah's Witnesses for labor. So I wrote a very extensive modern slavery submission of about 40 pages some years ago. I've done a couple of other podcasts just about modern slavery, but I think it's still not out there enough that people realize that they were essentially modern slaves. People that were in forced marriage and doing labor that they were unpaid and deceptively recruited for and moving between countries like missionaries. Have you heard of that before?
I haven't heard about the moving from country to country. That is disturbing. That's very interesting. The idea of doing menial work, going door to door, needing to sell, that I have heard about. When you were saying with your own pocket money, what do you mean? That you would need to pay for something? What would you need to pay for on top of being used in this way?
Yeah, so the magazines, Bibles, books, I can't remember exactly the cost, 20 cents, maybe 50 cents. And we would pay at the literature counter. Every kingdom hall had a literature counter. And you were required to give a certain amount of hours. So there's actually forms that you had to fill in that you were required, even as a child, to fill in how many hours of witnessing you did. So you were expected to have enough literature with you in your bag and then do hours. And it would usually be something like 3 or 4 hours on a Saturday, 3 or 4 hours on a Sunday. And then you had different levels of pioneer who did something like 100 hours a month or something like that. And so there were all different types of labor. And I don't know if you've heard of it couched as modern slavery before.
I think it's depending upon the definition of modern slavery, which I'm sure you've done your research on. If it fits all the characteristics, then I think one can safely call it that. I think also if you're needing to pay for things that then you're going to sell potentially and hope to recoup your losses or make a profit, I mean, that's also a pyramid scheme. I mean, that's multi-level marketing. There's so much here. That what's so interesting about what you're saying here is how people can be used, minors are used. I mean, if you left at 19 and you're talking about having done these things for years, that you were a minor for most of it, seems to be the case for a lot of people. But without having the language, without being able to call it this and having a term for it and the different characteristics of how you define that, then people don't know that this is what's happening to them. And that's why it's so important that you're clarifying the language here and also the legally recognized terms for what has happened.
Exactly. Yes, that's right. So I hope people think about that when they watch this or listen to this and they really think about what their childhood was like, because oftentimes the Jehovah's Witnesses will discount themselves. They will say, we're not as bad as the Scientologists. Or they will say, oh, we're not as bad as the glory of our cult in New Zealand. We didn't have to work from dusk till dawn, or dawn till dusk, rather. We weren't living in a commune. But people in our Bethels are living in a commune. They just don't recognize it as that. And things are as bad because there's so much mental health damage. It's not just coming from one thing. It's coming from many avenues. That might segue into the other topic that I wanted to raise with you. And it's a word you may not have heard of before, but it's one of the reasons I tell journalists and the government that people don't speak up. The word is endogamy. And what endogamy means, it means essentially that you're supposed to marry within your community. So we are very much encouraged to marry another Jehovah's Witness. And as you heard before, I wanted to escape that. I didn't want that. I didn't want to be trapped. But most of my Jehovah's Witness friends did marry a Jehovah's Witness man, or the boys that I knew married a Jehovah's Witness girl. And many of those marriages became very unhappy. And there's actually a lot of domestic violence within the Jehovah's Witnesses. There hasn't been any studies that I'm aware of. But what does it mean to say that the Jehovah's Witnesses are endogamous? It essentially means that you don't want to report because they're going to be related to you. You don't have the world around you to choose from for a partner. Your partnership is restricted. Usually, it's going to be your congregation or the next congregation or somebody that you meet at an assembly. And that's a very finite group of people. It's not inbreeding, because people aren't marrying their family, but it's their spiritual family that they have this undue influence to marry someone within the faith. And the same thing happens with the Exclusive Brethren, for example, with the Glory of El cult that I mentioned earlier, with the Mormons, even Catholics you want to marry. But that population of Catholics is a quarter of the population of Australia. So you have a huge pool to pick from. If you're going to report child abuse, for example, or you're going to say, I'm very poor, or you're going to say, I haven't had an education, that's unusual, really. It's not common to the Catholics. And if you reported the abuse, they're unlikely to be related. Well, we don't know the statistics probably, but I would argue that there's enough of a big population that you don't need to marry so closely. Whereas in the Jehovah's Witnesses in Australia, there's only 70,000. I think in the US, you have 1 million Jehovah's Witnesses. So there's more to choose from. But 1 million in, what's your population at the moment? 300 and something thousand?
Yeah, it's very large.
Yeah, it's really large.
Yeah.
I couldn't choose from that. If you think about the 1 million Jehovah's Witnesses, well, only half of them are men. So I can only choose from 500,000, but half of them are married. So I can only choose from 250,000, but half of them are still children. So I can only choose in the States to marry out of 125,000 Jehovah's Witnesses. So you can see how that endogamy really starts to encapsulate you and keeps you silent. The fact that you're not supposed to be worldly anyway keeps you silent. And I say endogamy keeps you silent and other things as well.
I think also the fear of God. You're doing something against God. You're making sure that you're not going to be saved. When they say, well, we're not as bad as Scientology, that's ridiculous. I mean, fine, but really? I mean, that would be like me saying, I'm not as bad as the mafia. What? Okay, what? Why is that a thing that I'm even going to say? Because it just makes me sound horrible that I'm saying that. But I also am wondering just about when people are in these kinds of situations where they feel like they have to toe the party line. They have to be very positive about what their group is all about. But at the same time, a lot of people who I've worked with, okay, it might not be as bad as Scientology in some ways. I've noticed from the clients I have who are former Jehovah's Witnesses, that they often have more nightmares than a lot of other cultic groups that I've dealt with. Might not be as bad in some ways, but it's worse in others. And there are so many visions in your head that you were raised with from a young child that are terrifying, really terrifying. I don't know what's better or worse.
Yes, that's true. I think that comes from the imagery. This is a magazine, The Watchtower, that I mentioned earlier. And the irony, as you said before, the irony, this one's entitled Religious Reform Now? ? Is from 1995. But let me open it and see if there's some of that imagery. Here's one, page 3. It's a sinking ship.
Oh my.
Let me find some more because there's usually several of them. Oh, here we go. And now you see people.
Oh, okay, yeah. Oh, that's terrifying.
In a storm, their ship is sinking. Then you see, it's not bad imagery. Let me see if there's any others in this magazine.
And as you're looking, these are stories that are told to people like, this will happen to you. This is the vision of your future, should you leave, or what happens to the world outside. How are these images introduced to people?
Yeah, so here's an example, although it's quite a beautiful picture. I'll just explain it to you. If you look at the face of the woman, that's Adam and Eve. She's being cast out, and you see how they're glamorizing being cast out of Eden. It looks like she's the guilty party. So, yes, there's certainly lots of pictures. I'm not sure if there's one of Armageddon in here. There's usually one of Armageddon, not this particular one, but there's usually, you know, fire raining down from heaven. And these days there are men with machine guns, for example, persecuting Jehovah's Witnesses, getting them together. There's lots of photos about war, pestilence. The Jehovah's Witnesses believe the Bible literally. These are not just stories. These things really happened in history and they will happen. The prophecies will happen. I don't know if you've heard the phrase Armageddon's just around the corner with the Jehovah's Witnesses. They say that all the time. Every time a prophecy fails, they still say it. And that's what the pictures are about. So certainly the fear of Armageddon, not just a fear of God, but the Armageddon that's coming to all of us and this urgent need to get as many extra Jehovah's Witnesses. And if you don't do it, you might not get through. Or if you've got a bad heart, you don't believe all of it and just accept it all willingly, you might not get through Armageddon. You're constantly in fear. And we had sleep terrors. I used to have sleep terrors where I felt that there was a wolf circumnavigating the house. I was just fearful constantly. And even though I didn't believe it, I say I didn't believe it, but the day that I left, I was still scared that God would strike me down with lightning. And many people have said that.
Yeah. I mean, there'd be no reason for you not to worry about that. I mean, when these fears are given to you, especially from a young age, they get under your skin. It takes quite a long time to undo that. And with everything that Jehovah's Witnesses, I think, go through when they're trying to come into the world, just being around things, people celebrating birthdays or holidays, and if someone offers you a gift, all the fears that are going to be coming up about what that all does to you. I'm kind of curious what your first birthday celebration was like after leaving. What was that like? Was it terrifying? Was it interesting? What was it like?
I actually can't remember which one it was. I think it wasn't the birthday freedom that is a lingering memory, but it was just the total freedom that is what I hold with me. For example, I put my feet up on my table, was never allowed to do that. And we had to have our elbows off the table. Sometimes I have my elbows on the table. It was the little things, you know, not having to wear petticoats, not having to cover up all of your skin. It was all the little things constantly. The release from preaching was probably the biggest thing for me. I just hated witnessing. I hated preaching and just not having any deadlines, not having any timelines that I had to meet, not having to put on a fake happy face for what they call the best life ever. Just the general freedom was the best thing for me. I do like to enjoy other people's birthdays. Christmas is the more important because birthdays, you can still be around people. Christmas can be very lonely for Jehovah's Witnesses. And so I think the best thing that we do is we often have what's called an orphan's Christmas, where we're all together because we don't have our family. So I enjoy those.
It's a lovely thing. Oh my goodness. it has been wonderful to speak with you and to meet you, to meet someone who is this strong, who is this directed, who is so clear about what is right and what is wrong here and what you want to be a part of healing or doing or educating. And I think it's really fantastic. I think it would be good for people to know if they wanted to find you and the work that you've done and just be able to get to know you and see you as a the superhero that you are. But if also if people want to contact you or find out about any kind of support systems for themselves once they've left this group, how can they do that?
I'm on Facebook and LinkedIn as Lara Kaput. So it's my real name, my real picture. You can Google submissions and witness testimony that I've given. So my full name is Larissa. So sometimes I write under Lara and sometimes I write under Larissa, more commonly as Lara. You can Google those, or they're mostly available on the website saysorry.org. And also if you look up the New South Wales Secular Association, you can find most of my submissions. You can find witness testimony and submissions under Hansard. Hansard is the formal record from the government. So I've made submissions in other countries as well, contributed to, for example, the grand jury in Pennsylvania on the Jehovah's Witnesses. In documentaries, you can look up Jehovah's Witnesses, Lara Kaput Media, and witness testimony is often found on Hansard as well. And for support, I recommend that you find a psychologist who has some cult background. There's relatively few now, but more are coming. I attended a New Zealand decult conference at which I was a speaker, and there were 80 psychologists trained in cults. People like Yanya Lalich was there, Dr. Lalich, Gilly Jenkinson was there helping to train people. That's one way you can get support. Another way is Facebook groups, for example, have support. The Reddit group has about 100,000 former Jehovah's Witnesses, and there's a website too called essentially Jehovah's Witnesses that you can get onto. So there are now many ways. Thank you for asking.
Of course, of course. Sending you support from one woman to another who's been in the trenches, who cares about this and has to kind of move their way around the people who might want to try to stop you along the way just to keep going. This affects so many people. Jehovah's Witnesses has been around for a long time, and it exists in, I think, almost every country. And so you're really helping so many people become educated. And also, I think, gaining more of an understanding about why it is that they are having night terrors, why they're having emotional issues, because that's not going to be given credibility or support within the organization. But Lisa, I think now you've offered a lot of framework, going back to your word, to understand why people might be having these emotional outcomes from their experience. Thank you so much, Lara.
Thank you for having me today. There's one more message I'd like to get out to everybody, and that is that I would really love to see more people make government submissions. You can make submissions to parliamentary inquiries, for example. You can suggest that grand juries are held in different states. There's one state that it's in right now, but it could happen in others. The other thing that they can do is they can give witness testimony. So if there's an opportunity to be part of a new bill, or if they find a way that the government is asking people for their feedback, they can make or provide witness testimony. So I really hope that more people do that. And thank you so much for your time and listening to the other topics today.
Oh, of course. Thank you so much. And thank you for sharing so much about your experience and also really illuminating any other people why they themselves are having the nightmares and the emotional issues from their time there, or they've noticed that in their loved ones. It helps to really get behind what might be causing that, especially if the group itself is not going to be taking responsibility or helping people with it, and they can really feel very much on their own. And so hopefully hearing you speak helps people feel much less isolated and much more understood. So thank you, Lara, for all that you do.
Thank you.
One more thing before you go. Thank you so much to Laura for all that she shared with us and all that she's been through and how much exposure she's given to so many people's stories and to things that she has felt, and rightfully so, needed to be uncovered about this group. It's an interesting thing when we talk about Jehovah's Witnesses, because I was raised like a lot of other people were raised, really feeling like it is another religion that is viable and as healthy as other religions are. I saw them everywhere. Well, I still see them everywhere with their pamphlets and their tables set up in parks and in front of theaters and other places. I did not actually know when I was growing up that this could be a problematic organization. And not just problematic in certain ways that have now come to light, but problematic psychologically. I started hearing from people after they heard me speak about cults in general, or they heard me talk about manipulation or coercion or fear-based religious intimidation and trauma. People were calling me and saying, hey, I feel like you're describing my experience growing up in the Jehovah's Witnesses. I feel like you are someone who knows about a child's experience when they're exposed to these tracts, these magazines that have pictures of Armageddon, and that becomes your bedtime story at night. I also was contacted by women and also men, but these stories specifically with women where they were caught on a date with someone, or they were caught arm in arm with a boy. And then the girls, really, as girls, were brought up in front of a council of older men who grilled them about all of their experiences, sexual experiences, or not even just sexual, but just being in the presence of a boy. And that from what they knew, the boys were not grilled in the same way, that it was always up to the girls to show that they had some level of self-control and that they could combat the feelings that they were having or the wishes just to be in close proximity to a boy. And sometimes the boys were also brought up before council, but usually if they were, there was no consequence. Not always, but usually. But for the girl, it seems, there was always a consequence. And that's how it is so often in so many religious organizations. I also know that I've worked with a lot of people who have dealt with night terrors and nightmares because of their time growing up, hearing about the fires of hell, hearing about demons, hearing about going to hell. If they don't keep themselves absolutely in line with their behavior, but also with their thoughts. And we all know that our mind sometimes takes us into certain places that can be a little sketchy, but also sometimes we just have thoughts that are natural, that are supposed to be happening when we go through certain levels of development. But in this group and others, you're made to feel that you're sinful. There's something tremendously wrong with you. There are a lot of times that people will talk to me about something that Laura brought up today, which is that they suffer with mental illness. They suffer with symptoms that are falling under the rubric of schizophrenia, and that people also have suicidal ideation or go through with killing themselves. It is a very sad situation indeed that this happens and that the numbers are high, statistically not what you would see in the general population, but much higher. There are people who will be hospitalized after having left a particular group that made them feel so fearful, made them feel not only fearful of the world, but fearful of their own drives, of their own mind, of their own thoughts. And then they feel like there's no way out, and the only way out is to end their lives. There are people who will also be diagnosed with certain kinds of diagnoses if they go and they're hospitalized in a psychiatric unit or they go to see a psychiatrist. And for some of them, they do have this disorder. But for most of them, from what I've seen, It's situational, like situational depression, situational psychosis. And it means that it's been brought on by experiences. It's not inherently who you are and how your brain was necessarily going to be functioning or going to be wired, but that given so much stress and so much that felt antagonistic to your true self, and without having a way out to feel like you could be safe and you could be seen as a good person and you could still have a relationship with God if that's what you wanted, that people do become despondent and they do become hopeless. There are also these ideas that are given to kids in some of these groups that they're supposed to have visions of things. They're supposed to have visions of heaven. They're supposed to have visions of hell. They're supposed to have visions, again, as we said, of demons, of monsters. And then when they start having visions, when they're older, they're labeled schizophrenic. It's a very unfair place where people have been backed into these kinds of corners, where ideas have been introduced to them. They then fall prey to those ideas. They then open their mind up to these ideas and then are labeled and discarded as quote unquote crazy. It is a catch-22 and beyond. I'm so sorry that it happens. It really is quite unfair. I'm so happy that Laura is able to talk about her experiences and that she was able to hold on to certain freedoms to be able to travel and speak and collect data and bring so much of it today to us. Thank you again to her. Take good care. Talk to you all next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.